Chapter 10. Death Chambers. There are some traditional properties that must always be upheld, except in the direst of emergencies. The current situation does not yet amount to such an emergency. And so it is that when George decides to inform another of his ilk of Sir David's worrying news, he does so by invoking a protocol steeped in antiquity. Not that Sir David himself realized that his news would be cause for concern. He saw nothing wrong with directing a tenth of £1 billion into an untried research project, and indeed that sum is only a small fraction of the bank's asset reserve. But George's nostrils flare, and his lips involuntarily crease into something like a sneer at the unwelcome memory dredged up by the miasma of meddling that Sir David trailed into his club. Sir David has been touched by a will not his own, and George cannot abide the stink of soiled goods, much less the threat that it brings. It's time for a parley with a rival, on neutral ground and in the absence of minions. Of course, for this marks a diminuendo in the century-long symphony of killing dictated by the law of vampires. Exactly an hour after midnight, a cast-iron gate creaks open, and a man steps through it, onto the gravel path beyond. Old George is shrouded against the chill of the night, his overcoat buttoned and hat-brim drawn low to partly conceal his face. His driver and regular bodyguard close and lock the gate behind him, then wait in the car. His possession of the keys to this venerable institution does not surprise them, for they are far beyond such a mental state after so long in his service. They will await his return patiently, and they will bite off their tongues and drown in their own blood before they speak of this to any man or woman now alive. Beyond the gate, it is as dark as a London night ever gets in this electrified age. A ruddy, sky-spattered glare deepens the shadows cast by woodland vegetation. The trees and bushes still sport autumnal leaves, but they rustle as dryly as any crypt-bound bones. His heels crunch quietly on the path as he walks between lichen-stained monuments, corroded by decades of acidic soot before coal fires were banished from the capital. He remembers the choking, acrid fog as it once saturated the graveyard air around him, providing concealment and dampening sounds. It was a comfort of sorts, rendering these approaches slightly less fraught. Now there's no night and mist to hide in if his contact has come adrift, hissing and snarling at the corrosive winds of time, and determined to drag George down with him when he goes. He has only the trees and the overgrown tombs and mausoleums to hide amidst. Well, those and his own defensive preparations. Even without consciously commanding the movement, his hand steals to his left pocket and pats it, outlining the slim black box within. It's a dead man's handle. If he does not press the button whenever the box vibrates, certain messages will be sent to trusted subordinates. The adversary will expect nothing less of him, and can be expected to conduct his affairs accordingly. He, too, probably carries a dead man's handle. It's just another step in the intricate and lethal waltz they've been dancing for decades. George stalks the familiar, tree-shrouded avenues and paths of Highgate Cemetery, past so many people he vaguely knew, and in many cases despised, in life. He belongs here, and indeed his will once specified that this should be his final resting place, but they have long since closed his preferred section to new burials. Coming to the impressive column-flanked entrance to Egyptian Avenue, its mouth pitch dark to regular human eyes, although George's night vision is preternaturally good, as sensitive as any cat's, he pauses and waits for a few seconds, closing his eyes and clearing his mind. One of his kind has been this way, and recently. They took no pains to conceal themselves, which is a good sign. He opens his eyes again and straightens his back as he steps forward into the pool of night between the tree-shadowed lintel. The older parts of Highgate Cemetery are preserved as woodland these days, overgrown with ivy-clad sycamore and ash trees, limestone and marble walls of gape-mouthed crypts gently aging into the landscape. Old George paces along a gravel-strewn path, past a wall set in a gentle hillside, pierced by classical columns and open doorways. His nostrils flare once more as he nears his destination, a wealthy Victorian family's final resting place, Not all of their niches are occupied. Indeed, one remains empty, for it is the one that had his name, an earlier name, earmarked for it. But it's not empty now. He pauses outside the entrance and speaks aloud, the words galling. May we speak in peace?
Yes, subject to the usual caveats.
The other is male, and speaks with an old London accent, tainted with mannerisms that strike George as modern affections, even though they predate the deplorable Americanisms that crept into everyday usage after the Second World War. George relaxes his facial musculature to an almost sheepish droop, carefully suppressing any expressive signatures. Very well, I shall speak from out here, he says carefully. I will caution that I did not request this rendezvous without reason. If you try to kill me, you will remain ignorant of a threat to your life, and mine, which is why I seek to make common cause. The tomb's occupant is silent for almost a minute. Then,
you mentioned a threat. Please describe it. Then we can discuss the possibility of cooperation.
Listen up, peeps, says Mary. This is critically important. There will be an exam, and if you fail, the consequences could be, shall we say, worse than career-limiting.
A lot can happen in a couple of days. In this case, there has been a drastic realignment of status among the scrum. All the status markers are scrambled, for one thing, because a casual Friday dress code applies, today being Saturday, and the office theoretically being closed. Mary sits at the head of the table, in leggings and a little black dress, accessorized out of the spectrum of regular office wear. Oscar is off to one corner, kicked back in chinos and a polo shirt, bearing the bank's logo, one loafer crossed over an immaculately creased leg. The others are variously attired in jeans and button-down shirts, except for Dick, who has accessorized his usual Oxfam surplus tweed suit with an ancient Cradle of Filth t-shirt, lovingly tie-dyed using his own vomit. This is Dick's unique interpretation of office casual.
You're doubtless wondering what the hell is going on and what this bunch of government crap is about and what it's got to do with you. So, let me explain. Our power, talent, what have you, does not exist in a vacuum. The government got there first, back during the war. Apparently Alan Turing had something to do with it. Anyway, there's a field of applied mathematics that lets you contact extra-dimensional beings, and a whole side field called applied computational demonology. Stop picking your nose and pay attention, Dick, you animal. And during the war, a division of SOE, that's the Special Operations Executive, was set up to perform occult operations. It turns out we live in a multiverse, and there are things with too many tentacles. Yes, Evan, I'm talking about Cthulhu here. Yes, yes, I know. The laundry, they were originally headquartered above a Chinese laundry in the West End, is the branch of the Secret Service for protecting the UK from the scrum of the multiverse. And that means us. Do you understand?
Mary glances around the motley gaggle of mathematicians, system administrators, and bankers. Out of pinstripe uniform, they could be a bunch of Saturday afternoon role players or canal boating enthusiasts. Superficial appearances are misleading, precisely because, so much of the time, they're accurate. And it is a very good thing indeed that the scrum's appearance is at odds with its nature.
We can't go out in daylight. We're super strong, we have a taste for blood, and we can make people do what we want. Oh, and we got there by way of Dick and Evan's sterling work in visualization and Alex's five-dimensional group isomorphism, which is, shall we say, laundry territory. We are the sort of things they have nightmares about. And because it's their job to spot things like us, it was pretty much inevitable that sooner or later we would come to their attention. If we come to their attention in a bad way, that would be very bad. They play for keeps, and they have kissing cousins in the military, never mind the police. The least bad outcome would involve padded cells and a lot of intrusive medical tests. The worst? You don't want to know about the worst. Just think how every vampire movie you've ever seen ends. Then imagine that instead of a handful of half-assed vampire-hunting heroes, you're up against a Cold War-era government agency. However, there's an escape clause. If you're on the inside, pissing out, they will find a pigeonhole to put you in. Practitioners end up in very odd places all the time, and the laundry has a habit of recruiting anyone with any remotely non-deniable exposure to the real no-shit occult. 15 years ago, that was me. I spent a couple of years in there before convincing them to put me on permanent unpaid sabbatical, with an employment placement thrown in. Which is why I had the contacts in place with Human Resources to get you all listed as new personnel acquisitions earlier this week, before our visitor dropped in for a chat. She pauses to take a drink from the water glass on the table. This not being a meeting organised by their employer, the glass contains a liquid other than water. A Bloody Mary would be gauche, but a G&T goes down fine. Unavoidable side effects. You will all have to accept that for the foreseeable future, you are going to be inducted into an annoyingly sluggish and overstaffed part of the civil service, and they will expect to have first call on your time. You are going to have to sign a schedule to the Official Secrets Act that most people don't even know exists, and fill out a lot of paperwork. You will then spend at least a month on evaluation and training on their premises. Indoctrination is more like it. While they assess your personality and aptitudes and make you jump through hoops, then give you a whistle-stop tour of the organization's divisional structure and a couple of training wheels assignments. Luckily, we are all classified as key workers, because the bank is a strategic national asset, so they don't get to keep us forever. It's a bit like a territorial army enlistment. They can grab us for a month every year, but they have to square it with HR, and management won't be allowed to ask any irritating questions or fire us for being out of the office. If you do precisely what I tell you to do, say the right things, and refrain from scaring the crap out of them by showing what you're capable of, Oscar and I will do our best to get this organization recognized within the laundry as a semi-autonomous research cell, part of a strategic national asset, hands-off, etc. Do you understand?
Janice has been getting visibly spikier throughout the entire briefing, and now she sounds off.
You're talking Men in Black, the Van Helsing remix, aren't you? And you think you can make them take us in? Are you out of your fucking tree?
Now wait up. Oscar starts up, but Mary overrides him.
I spent 3 years in Human Resources in the laundry, Mary says evenly. Yes, secret government agencies have HR departments and facilities and office management issues. It's not James Bond territory over there. Yes, there are autonomous research cells. I've handled payroll for them. Yes, there is a mandatory one-month induction course. Yes, you will be subjected to a Myers-Briggs test, an interview under polygraph, except it's not a skin galvanometer. They've got a tame, subsentient Class II emanation, a demon to you, that feeds on mendacity. If you knowingly tell a lie, it will snitch on you, not to mention undergoing a graphologist's report, a medical, and a bunch of spurious make-work. You'll be given a mentor, another recent inductee, who will show you around the offices. But as long as you manage not to shit the bed by ripping your line manager's throat out and drinking their blood, you will very likely pass muster. And if you manage to look bumblingly useless, they'll get bored and let you go after a while. Are we clear?
Evan raises his hand. Why? He asks succinctly.
What are the benefits?
Mary glances at Oscar, who nods minutely. She begins counting off points on her fingers.
Firstly, they can't do the whole monster-hunting thing on our ass and kill us, because we're inside the magic circle. Or did you miss our visitor the other night?
Her expression of disdain looks theatrically exaggerated to those of her audience, who are unaware of her former relationship with Mr. Howard, a.k.a. your humble narrator.
Secondly, we gain access to their resources and knowledge base. Thirdly, we are in a position, once we all know what we're doing, to leverage their connections to our collective advantage. Fourthly, Oscar is working on a plan.
She smiles tightly.
Oscar?
Oscar nods and scoots his chair forward as Mary pulls back. I'm not going to tell you the details just yet, he says. Hell, I haven't made my mind up yet. There's a polygraph test and loyalty oath stuff coming up. What you haven't decided to do yet, you can deny planning. In any case, it's somewhat speculative at this point. But Mary and I have been examining our options, and we have identified a possible exit strategy from this scenario. If we can, if we decide to develop it,
We will generate a narrative and execute in due course. Those who decline to opt in will merely get left behind with a sinecure in the civil service or the bank, whichever you choose. I want to stress that we have not yet confirmed this is going to happen, and if it does, you don't have to join us. I believe if you do join us, there will be sacrifices to be made. Plastic surgery, false identities, exile from the UK for the foreseeable future. But on the other hand, we won't execute unless the payoff is in excess of $10 billion. And £1 billion plus for each of us should make up for a lot of inconvenience, shouldn't it? Anyway, whether you want to join in the bust-out or not, we're all going to need to go through this laundry organization's induction process in the next few weeks, and do so without incriminating ourselves. I've asked Mary to develop a story list around the theme of setting up a successful presentation of the Scrum to the laundry as an autonomous unit, and we're going to work through it and use the rest of this session to take our sprint assignments. During induction, we'll meet each evening after work to discuss progress and conduct backlog grooming. The laundry has no need to be aware of this. I don't think it's a hanging offense, but it would certainly alarm any competent counterintelligence officer if they knew we were approaching our insourcing with systematic coordination. So, I'm calling a 15-minute break for refreshments, and then we begin. Item 1. How to pull the wool over an intelligence agency's eyes.
Words are exchanged across the threshold of a crypt. A quantitative research group operating within one of the major investment banks appears to have transcended their humanity. Unfortunately, the outbreak was not confined to an individual. Worse, these people, who include a number of gifted mathematicians, are not practitioners of the art. They had no context within which to understand their new state, other than that provided by the mass media.
Oh dear.
I believe they may have drawn unwanted attention to themselves already.
Unconscionable.
I agree completely. It is interesting to speculate as to what might have prompted them to pursue such an unfortunate line of research.
Yes, yes it is. What sort of scrutiny do you think they've attracted?
The heirs of the Invisible College have taken a direct interest. There was a visit. As our very own insider, that would make them very emphatically your problem.
There is a muffled thud from within the crypt, as of a fist striking a stone-hard palm in frustration.
Intolerable!
I quite agree.
What is to be done, in your opinion?
I am too closely associated with the source of this information to act without risk of coming to the attention of the investigators. The new data mining techniques.
Yes, I understand.
Also, your connections.
That too. What do you have for me?
Old George unfastens the top two buttons of his overcoat.
One of my people in the bank provided my servant with the necessary passwords to connect his PC to the bank's network. I confess I don't fully understand such things, but it proved sufficient. I brought a summary of their personnel files for your edification.
He withdraws a cardboard folder from his coat, then kneels and carefully places it before the tomb, then stands and buttons his coat up.
How am I to know that this is not some trap?
The tomb's occupant asks, a trifle querulously.
Don't be silly,
old George finally snaps. How long have we known each other?
68 years too long, if you ask me.
There is a pause in the conversation.
Never mind. If they're truly ascended but ignorant, they will be easy prey. If they're not ignorant, well, we shall deal with that contingency if it arises. But mark my words, George, I resent this. Why can't you send your bloody-handed catspaw to take care of them?
Because she's about as subtle as a battalion of Cossacks, and, as I intimated, they have already come to the attention of the people you hide among.
Bah! So you decided to dump your problem in my lap?
It's our problem, old enemy. We have the same stake in its speedy resolution.
Be that as it may, there'll be a price. You're asking me to risk my own skin.
Do you think I don't know that? Think of a price, then name it. This lack of trust is unbecoming.
There is silence for a while. Then,
your lady executioner, Lend her to me.
Old George tenses. I think you misapprehend the degree of control I exert over her.
Really? You created her, didn't you?
The other's tone is light, almost mocking. Yes, but she's not mine to command, George admits.
What? She's not a minion? Did you turn—
Certainly not. But her utility depends upon her retaining the illusion of free will, and upon certain other delicate conditioning. She's like a very sharp Japanese sword with no guard. If your fingers slip—
Yes, yes, you'll cut yourself, I understand. Ahem. Why, may I ask, did you create such an uncontrollable and dangerous tool?
Because, like you, I am a creature out of time and a fish out of water. This is not our century. We live among strangers who have replaced the people we knew in our youth. For my first century, buried in my research, I barely noticed the changes. But after the Great War, it became clear that I could no longer move unnoticed among the common herd. Nor, I imagine, can you. So I have made it a habit to forge a new tool every decade or two, taking the bright metal of youth and hardening and shaping it. She is merely my latest and deadliest.
By tool, you mean predator?
Yes, of course. And she is very good at it, isn't she?
You know I am immune to her particular methodology, your Black Widow.
Yes, but you are not the type of prey this hunter is trained for.
Whereas our current irritant is, for the most part. So lend her to me!
Not unless you tell me why you want her. As I said, she's as subtle as a battalion of Cossacks.
Yes, you did say that. That's why I want her.
You need a decoy?
There is a pause.
Yes.
Very well, then. I shall send you her file. But I must caution you. Firstly, if you break her, you will provide me with a suitable replacement. Secondly, I have installed a safety catch. You will not be able to use her against me. And finally, remember that this blade has no guard.
I assure you I shall heed those warnings. Goodbye, George. May we not meet again for a very long time.
Old George freezes in place for a few seconds, staring at the doorway. Then he darts forward, limbs blurring in motion, and grabs something from behind the lintel, before he ducks aside and rolls, presenting the Kevlar-lined back of his coat to the opening. The explosion he half expects fails to happen. After a few seconds he stands and dusts himself down, before examining the contents of his palm. Exposed wires and a compact speaker gleam in the bloody after-midnight glow reflecting from the clouds. George nods at the empty tomb, acknowledging his old enemy's willingness to learn new tricks. A decade or two ago it would have been a bomb on a wire. Now it's a remote speaker, doubtless on a line to a mobile phone buried in the bushes. He turns and strides back the way he came. His rival is satisfyingly canny. Younger and weaker than George, but more flexible and willing to experiment with new techniques, he has once more declined to present his throat to his elder's knife. At the same time, he has offered his cooperation, which means there is a truce, at least for the now. The law states that whenever two vampires meet, only one shall live. The youngsters in the bank are ignorant of the law, but ignorance is no defence, and soon they will learn about it the hard way. I think I'm ready for it, for the usual after-mission crash and subsequent messy, shaky calm-down, when Mo awakens, screaming and choking for breath in the middle of the night. But this time I couldn't be more wrong. This is the pattern of our domestic life, that we keep each other sane. Mo and I both run errands for the laundry. I tend to be sent to investigate problems and work out what's going wrong. Why are there too many concrete cows in Milton Keynes? Why a livery stable on a farm in Sussex is ordering 50 kilos of offal a day from the local abattoir? That sort of thing. Yes, these jobs sometimes blow up in my face and give me nightmares for years afterwards, but that's all part of the rich tapestry of life. But Mo's job is different. She gets sent to troubleshoot problems that have already exploded. Normally she divides her working week between lecturing in mathematics at one of London University's better-known colleges and practicing with her violin, but once in a while she's called upon to pick up the violin, go somewhere, and fiddle until blood trickles down from her fingertips. She does not play happy Highland jigs. That damned instrument, and the word damned is an accurate description, not an expletive, is one of the organization's nastier assets. They placed it in her custody nearly a decade ago, because she had an aptitude for the violin as an instrument. It used to be her hobby. When she was in her teens, she briefly considered attending a music academy, but mathematics and philosophy won the toss. And she understands the eldritch mathematics used to describe the harmonics it is capable of achieving. Not many people can use an Eric Zahn instrument effectively, and even fewer can do it for any length of time without ending up in a padded cell. So, after I get some food down her throat, not to mention half a bottle of wine, I run a bath for her and make small talk about office gossip. She's pretty tired, so after she dries herself off and starts yawning, I accompany her to the bedroom. She gets into bed, and at first leans the violin case against her side of the mattress, but then rolls over and lifts the thing onto the duvet and curls around it, for all the world as if it's a teddy bear. I turn out the lights and wrap myself around her, spooning protectively, and within a couple of minutes she begins to snore. I lie awake for a while. It's not that I'm not tired, but the violin is creeping me out. I can sense it, bony and hard-edged and hot. When I close my eyes, I can't help seeing with that other inner eye. With my eyes closed, I can see through Mo, human, warm, breathing softly, occasionally shifting against me, and through the case to the bony horror within. It's red and raw and pulses slowly, and I swear the thing is looking right back at me. It's not like sharing a bed with a teddy bear, more like a rabid attack dog who tolerates my presence only because the owner it is obsessively enthralled to is lying unconscious between us. The violin doesn't like me. The violin has never liked me. I think the only reason it puts up with me is because of what I do for Mo. And if I ever stop doing it...
I can't...
Mo sits bolt upright in bed, making choking noises and wheezing. Somehow, despite the presence of the instrument, I manage to drift off to sleep. As she wakes up in the grip of her night terror, she yanks the bedding away from both of us, and I thrash around, turning away from her, as I try to pull myself back from the edge of deep dream sleep. I am naturally scared witless by the choking thing, and I make a couple of grabs for the bedside light before I succeed in turning it on to push back the darkness. Then I sit up and put an arm round her shoulders. She's stopped choking, but she's breathing frantically fast, and I can feel her pulse hammering. Mo, I say inanely. Are you all right? Mo! After a moment, she manages to nod. I stroke her spine and upper back, shoulder blades and ribs. She's as tense as a tow rope under load, still breathing too fast. I keep stroking and rubbing, and after a minute she suddenly twists her upper body and wraps her left arm around me, burying her face in the cleft between my shoulder and the side of my neck. Then the sobbing starts. I notice with distaste that she is still holding on to the violin case's handle, with her right hand twisted behind her, but I don't dare try to detach it from her grip at this point. We sit there awkwardly for some time, holding each other while she sobs her heart out by dead of night. I feel helpless, and it's awful. I'm hugging my wife, vibrant, alive, and lovely, but she's in pain, and I can do nothing to help relieve her agony except to be here, waiting for the memory abscess to burst and release whatever festering vileness has been poisoning her dreams. It feels wrong, and we're being watched all the time by the jealous attack dog on the bed behind her, chewing on the stump of its tail, thinking mad thoughts, waiting for me to let down my guard, or for Mo to lose her temper with me. Finally, Mo sighs, then sniffs yet again.
It was an exorcism, she tells me.
I cautiously reach behind me for the bedside table, hunting with my fingertips for a box of tissues. I miss, and they go spilling across the floor. Do you want to blow your nose? I ask. Yes, it was an exorcism. Clearly, the exorcism went badly. I realize with a sense of further foreboding that the Iranian secret police wouldn't have requested foreign assistance for anything they could deal with using their own resources, but I don't say that.
She'll tell me when it's time. Kleenex. Sniff. Her death grip on my back relaxes. Do we still have that single malt I like? The special Glenmorangie one? Would you be a dear and fetch it? Will you be all right? She nods. I get a good look at her. Her eyes are red-rimmed and puffy, and her nose is dripping like a three-year-old who's just been told that Santa doesn't exist. But she's awake, and getting a handle on whatever it was that woke her up, which doesn't bode well for getting back to sleep. Elsewhere in London, another woman wakes alone in a cold and empty bed, to hear a telephone ringing elsewhere in her apartment. She's a light sleeper, and the ringtone in question belongs to a landline that her employer provided. Its demands are never to be ignored. The bell rings. She salivates. And on this occasion finds herself already fully awake and halfway down the hall, pistol in hand, before the third ring. The phone manages another ring before she gets to it, in the living room.
Speaking,
she says tensely. Only one man has the number for this line, and a black box routes all random robocallers into a maze of twisty little voicemail boxes, lest they annoy her. Consequently, it only rings when her employer has a task for her.
Marianne, your employer gave me your number.
The adrenaline spike triggered by these words makes her shudder from the tips of her toes to the ends of her blonde ponytail. She carefully places the pistol on the sideboard beside the phone base station, then clenches her fist.
Really?
Yes. The midnight caller sounds slightly amused. Going by the tone of voice, he's male, although there are devices for obscuring that.
George mentioned some instructions he gave you for this contingency.
The woman who calls herself Marianne shudders again, then repeats her long memorized line.
What time of night do you call this?
The witching hour,
which is the correct counterphrase.
I'm not a witch.
Which is a statement of fact and not a password.
I know. George told me all about you. How many vampires have you taken this year?
Marianne raises her right hand to her mouth and bites the top joint of her thumb quite hard.
Only one.
Quiet frustration.
Are you a vampire? Are you looking for a date?
She lives in hope. Although any sane vampire who knows what she is will think twice before flirting with her.
Let's just say I'm playing matchmaker.
He sounds dryly amused. She clutches the phone tightly, trying not to get her hopes up despite the thrill of anticipation.
I have a number of candidates in mind for you, if you'd like to meet them. At least five, possibly more.
Oh, yes. She almost goes weak at the knees.
Yes, of course.
It sounds better than she could possibly have imagined. What's the catch?
Why so many? Nest has come to our attention. George is otherwise occupied, so...
She puts two and two together.
You're his old playmate, aren't you? The one that got away.
She manages to suppress a girlish squeal of delight.
The one he keeps grumbling about. He grumbles about me. I had no idea. I'm flattered. But that's as may be. George agreed to loan your services to me in pursuit of this, common goal. You can confirm this, by the way. Call him up. Set your mind at ease.
I'm always at ease.
I'm delighted to hear it. Anyway, to the task in hand. We will have to work closely together. I can assist you in isolating the targets, but the actual, kiss. Yes, the kiss is entirely up to you. The first couple should be easy enough to steal, but thereafter we will have to make them come to us.
You'll bring them to me, she says breathily, her heart pounding.
I can't do that if you try to, kiss me, he says, but I am old and ugly, and these are virile young bucks from the city.
She takes a deep breath.
For 5 or 6 dates in a row, I'll happily do what you want. It's been so long,
she silently adds.
Excellent, her caller purrs. I'll be in touch.
Click. The line goes dead. She replaces the receiver, then stares at it wistfully. There's an unaccustomed warmth in her belly, a tremulous hope emerging. Whoever her caller is, Old George would not have lightly given him her number, which means this is certainly the real thing. She is a fetishist, of the type known to the very few people who study such recondite, occult perversions as a fang-fucker. Old George found her, and carefully trained and polished her. It is her delight and her pleasure to serve whenever he sends her on a date. But the past year has been a cold and lonely one, a famine of the flesh. She has been haunted by the nagging fear that her employer has tired of her, that she's doomed to the same future as an aging call girl, whose clientele have dried up. But now...
A nest. At least five. Be still, my beating heart.
Leaving Mo sobbing in the bedroom, I head downstairs, grab a couple of tumblers and rummage around the bottle rack for the single malt in question. The bottle's still about half full. Neither of us is fond of drinking alone, which is a good thing. I find a spare box of tissues on the kitchen worktop and hook it on a little finger, then take the stairs back up to the bedroom two at a time. But I needn't have bothered. Mo is moist but composed, if a bit fragile-looking. "Here," I say, shaking the box of tissues loose over her lap. "I'll pour." I put the glasses down, uncork the bottle, and serve up a couple of uneven double fingers of whiskey. Mo gets the marginally taller tumbler once she finishes dabbing at her eyes. The bloody violin is leaning against her bedside table, and she's let go of it, hallelujah. And I get back into bed beside her, and plump up the pillows so we've got something to lean against. You don't have to talk about it unless you want to. She sips thoughtfully at the amber liquid. Her hair's a mess of twisted locks, almost in dreads. Still coppery red, although much of that comes from a bottle these days. Evidently wearing a headscarf disagrees with it, and she hasn't had the time or energy to untangle it.
"Maybe some good will come of it," she says quietly. "They'll have to stop the mass executions."
I bite my tongue. Then I take an incautiously large sip from my own glass. Gears crunch in my head. She's back from Iran. In the past few years, since the Arab Spring and the Green Uprising that failed, the always dependable draconian regime has been going mad. So mad that our own conservative government, catchphrase hang 'em and flog 'em, who have hitherto been enthusiastically rendering all due assistance to the Iranian heroin traffic interdiction cops through the usual international police intelligence channels, have been backing away and muttering about not going too far, chaps. "What happened?" I ask, queasily curious.
"Case Nightmare Green strikes again."
Mo sips at her whiskey, clutching the tumbler in both hands to steady it, and my heart sinks. Case Nightmare Green is the end of the world, more or less. Magic is a side effect of computation, and we're building too damn many microprocessors in too damn many toys these days. Worse, we can't stop. Civilization will fall apart if we don't have singing Christmas cards and intelligent gas meters, apparently. But there are other sources of computation. Human brains are computing machines par excellence, and the more of them there are, the more thaumaturgic processor cycles we produce. The whole thing is a runaway positive feedback loop. While the demographic transition to a low birth, low death rate means we're near the top of the population roller coaster, it's going to take us a long time to get rid of all those surplus brains and the microprocessors they depend on. And in the meantime, the ultrastructure of reality is becoming extra porous. Magic is getting easier to practice and more powerful, and the things that live behind the walls of the universe are becoming intrigued by the smell of thinking fodder that wafts its way towards them. The stars are coming right, reality is coming apart at the seams, and we'll all go together when we go. Oh, and we can't even murder our way clear of it early. The deliberate killing of thinking beings, or thinking machines for that matter, there is a reason we really don't want to see any progress in AI, generates huge thaumic fields that can be used for want of a better word, necromancy. And if we don't use the power, someone or something else will.
There's a prison near a city in the north of Iran called Mashhad. I don't know where, exactly. They put me up in an airport hotel overnight.
then shipped me there in an Air Force helicopter. It's called Vakilabad, and it's near the border. They get a lot of drug traffickers there. Well, mules, illiterate, debt-poor Afghan refugees who cross the border on foot with half a kilo of heroin in their pockets. There's no fence on the frontier and no signs to tell them that the Islamic Republic of Iran has the death penalty for possession of 20 grams and that they won't get a defence lawyer.
Which is what gave our delightful Home Secretary cold feet about cooperation. See, here in the UK, 20 grams of heroin is good for a slap on the wrist if you're an addict, maybe a 6-month sentence if they think you're dealing. A mule caught entering the UK with half a kilo is going to get somewhere between a 5- and 8-year sentence, with time off for good behaviour and deportation at the end. Scragging them is seen as a bit of an overreaction, especially as HMG is signatory to a whole bunch of treaties requiring us to work towards the abolition of the death penalty worldwide. Mo takes a much bigger mouthful of whiskey, closes her eyes and swallows. Then she starts spluttering. I take her tumbler and refill it, wait for the coughing to subside, then offer it to her. She continues, quietly and with remarkably little effect.
Vakilabad is a large prison, and there is a shed in the prison with a substantial roof beam running its length. They hang people from the beam. They make the prisoners stand on tall stools, then kick them away. It can take 60 bodies at one time, they told me. And although they seldom fill it up, they use it every week. It's the world's largest gallows. They're very proud of it.
She puts her glass down. I hug her for a while, speechless with the horror of it.
My contact was a man named Ahmad from the Vevak. What I thought I was getting into was a straightforward decontamination job, clearing up a battlefield from the Iran-Iraq war, where there'd been a huge human wave attack, followed by a haunting. And that's what Ahmad seemed to think too when he met me. It was all fairly laid back at first, until a bunch of Pasdaran Special Force troops turned up, led by a lieutenant, that's the Revolutionary Guard. And they told Ahmad that the real problem was that the governor of Vakilabad prison had been unable to carry out any executions for nearly a month because a djinn, an evil spirit, had... Well,
she's shaking. I need another nip, she adds, pulling free and picking up her tumbler again. A djinn? I ask, then bite my tongue again. It's not my job to prompt her. She'll spill when she's good and ready.
Well, there was a bit of an argument, and I nearly stamped my foot and told them it was a breach of protocol. But you don't want to get into a pissing match with the local equivalent of the Waffen-SS. Ahmad said later that he'd had a bad feeling about the assignment from the start, thought it was a whitewash for something, but he didn't like to say. So anyway, they piled us into a couple of Toyotas and drove us from the airport to the prison. A horrible place. It smelled of shit and despair. Once inside, we were taken directly to this shed, the death chamber. I was afraid, you know? You can never be quite certain what the Revolutionary Guards are planning because they are entirely rational, within the constraints of a belief system that is based on crazy and mutually contradictory axioms. But they gave me the VIP treatment, tea and refreshments, and they let me keep my instrument, so... We got to the death chamber. There were 4 bodies hanging there, and they were clearly dead, but not in the manner prescribed by law. The execution party had left in a hurry. 3 of the stools were still upright. The victims were levitating, Bob, hovering just below the beam the ropes were tied to, and their eyes were glowing. You know what I mean? The bioluminescence thing? Luminous worms in the darkness. They were all quite dead, and the smell was atrocious. They'd been floating there for a week, chanting, Oderhal amedin aset, Oderhal amedin aset, over and over again, through dead men's throats.
She pauses for another suck at the water of life, and I follow her example.
I asked Ahmad. It means he is coming, he explained. Ahmad was clearly just inches away from crapping himself with fear. Now please would you banish the djinn that is haunting gallows so these fine fellows will let us go?
She transfers her whiskey glass to her left hand and reaches behind her with the right to touch the violin case.
I demanded some more background. Vakilabad has been busy for the past few years. He wouldn't tell me how many people they'd hang there, but when I guessed over 1,000, he didn't correct me downwards. Seems the execution parties had been troubled by odd sounds, emanations, chills and thumps and wails for some time. They'd put it down to, well, you can guess. I checked, then, and the background thaum reading was off the scale. Executions are a form of human sacrifice, after all, and this was death magic on a huge scale.
She takes another sip. She's draining the glass steadily. I reckon she's only got 10 or 15 minutes left before she drinks herself into a stupor. What she's telling me suggests I ought to join in, lest I have some very bad dreams. So I knock back a burning mouthful of spirit. It's singularly disrespectful to a portwood finished single malt, but it's too late to go back to the bathroom cabinet to check if there's any temazepam left. Mixing drink and sedatives is dangerous.
I had a dilemma, love.
I feel her shoulders relax slightly.
If it had been a normal exorcism, I'd have had no problem helping out. But they wanted the death chamber clearing down and neutralised so they could go back to hanging people. Nobody gave a shit about the thaum count until it got in the way of them strangling illiterate peasants. But then it was all, oh, Interpol will know someone who can help us out, won't they?
She falls silent for a moment. Then, fiercely,
I will not be complicit, an enabler for a judicial mass murder.
I swallow.
You refused? But what? I tried to refuse at first. The Pastoran officer was really angry, although Ahmad said he understood. They had a big shouting match. I mentioned the European Convention on Human Rights and the recent EU Commission ruling on withdrawal of coordination of drug interdiction until they ceased executions, and pointed out I'd be violating our own policy guidelines if I didn't obtain a legal waiver from the Home Office first. Then Firouz, the Pasdaran lieutenant, threatened to make me stay in the death chamber until I cooperated. With a Greek chorus of corpses chanting in the background and a thaum level off the scale. And he had his hand on his pistol, still holstered, and he was giving me the eye. You know? Well, no, you probably don't. You're male. But anyway, I lost my temper. So I nodded and smiled and took out my violin and made the dead men dance. The cadavers dropped, one by one. And so did Firouz. He'd threatened me, so I used his soul as duct tape to paper over the crack that had opened under the gallows.
She takes a final sip, draining her tumbler. I nod along with her, not trusting myself to speak. This is a part of my work, you see. The organisation puts Mo in situations where the only way to survive is to become one of the monsters, and it's part of my job to hold her together, even when she does things that make me want to throw up.
The Pasdaran soldiers were freaked out and scared, but I took enough from their souls that they didn't have the wits to realise I was responsible. They can be subtle when they need to. And Ahmad, he got it. I explained that this power doesn't come without a cost, and that if they began hanging people again, anywhere within the jail's walls, there'd almost certainly be a resumption. But what are we to do with the smugglers and criminals? He asked. Stop killing them, I suggested. He said he thought it was a good idea and he'd pass it up the line, which means he'll write a report and they'll ignore it. Then the Pasdaran sergeant decided that waiting around in a haunted execution shed with a spook and a crazy foreign woman and a lieutenant who just died of causes unknown was a bad idea. So they shoved us all in the back of a truck and drove me back to the airport. And here I am, look at me, I'm not shaking, I'm not mad, I'm just so angry I could kill someone.